The Shaggy Jenkins Show.
We have to make Russia great again.
On the Pacifica Radio Network.
It's the Shaggy Jenkins Show on the Pacifica Radio Network. Welcome to it. Today, we've got a lot to cover, including some weird new stuff about border security that's not officially on the books. The KKK shot their leaders away. Nexium, we'll catch up with them. Plus, we'll talk all about the latest from the fallout that is known as the Mueller Report. Before we get to all of that, some brief introductions are in line. Welcome to my show. I'm a critical thinker, problem solver, guy just left and normal and sane. My name is Shaggy Jenkins. I can be found at my website, shaggyjenkins.com, or wherever fine social media is served, at Shaggy Live. Well, before we begin, we should say that it is Easter vacation week, so a lot of the correspondents are off. And as such, I thought I would just jump up here and cover some stories that we usually don't get a chance to talk about. One is in depth about the border security story. Now, here's the thing. There was an issue, then there wasn't an issue, then there was a crisis that wasn't a crisis, then there was a caravan that actually wasn't a caravan, that wasn't full of the people we thought it was. The southern border has been one of those hot button issues that has been long and hard, well, hard to avoid. It's been politically polarizing on the part of the Republicans, including one Donald J. Trump, President of the United States. And all of the talking and all of the just rah, rah, rah bandwagon has finally led to one thing happening. Armed groups are now taking it upon themselves to, quote-unquote, shore up the security along the southern border. Now, one of these groups is, led by a 69-year-old white guy whose name is Larry Hopkins, but he's also known as Johnny Horton. No, he is not the Reverend Horton Heat. But the thing is that Johnny Hopkins, age 69, took it upon himself to gather a bunch of people around, calling themselves the United Constitutional Patriots. Now, these guys decided to go along the border and make sure that none of them dirty immigrants were getting into our country, and as such decided to set up their own stop, frisk, and arrest checkpoints. Now, this, of course, is highly illegal. Let's just throw that out there. It's highly illegal to do that. You cannot establish a private police force in any state without, it's just illegal, all right? It's bad. But this is the thing. New Mexico's new mayor, who was the one that kind of caught these guys doing what they were doing along their southern border, Michelle Lujan Grisham, decided that, you know what? I'm going to order an investigation. In that investigation, there was so much evidence found of, like, Hopkins being, quote-unquote, the national commander for the United Constitutional Patriots, has half a dozen members camped out on a rotating basis near Sunland Park since late February. These guys, armed, walked around, and if they thought somebody was an illegal, well, they stopped them and, quote-unquote, detained them. Now, the UCP describes itself as a patriot group, and this is the problem with the president's rhetoric. He talks about racism, xenophobia, and misogyny as all being wrapped up in a return to American traditional patriotism. And as such, he's inspired guys like Larry Mitchum Hopkins, a.k.a. Johnny Horton Heat. No, just Johnny Horton. Nobody knows obscure rockabilly bands from the 1990s, Shaggy. But Larry led these guys dressed in camouflage, carrying rifles, and quote-unquote helped United States Border Patrol detain over 5,600 migrants in the last 2 months alone. Now, video posted up by the group shows members telling migrants to stop, sit down, and wait for agents. Now, critics accuse the UCP of actually impersonating law enforcement, which is, once again, a huge illegal thing. Now, crowdfunding sources, you usually, in the wake of an arrest like this, especially one that the membership of UCP, the United Constitutional Patriots, says is nothing more than a political arrest motivated by Grissom, the New Mexico governor. The problem is that this group isn't a sanctioned law enforcement body. They are not deputized through any sort of sheriffry. And when it comes to the United States Border Patrol, they are not authorized to act on their behest. So when all of this stuff started swirling around, crowdfunding sources realized that they would be the target in the aftermath. And as such, PayPal, GoFundMe have already cut off any sort of bidding or funding that could possibly benefit the UCP. Now, they cited the policies on their TOS's, Terms of Service Agreement. They said that they are, quote-unquote, making sure they don't promote hate or violence. And this is after the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, called this group a fascist militia. So after all is said and done, with all of these groups vying for some sort of attention in New Mexico's border, who finally steps in but the FBI? And they arrested Larry Mitchell Hopkins. They said that this is basically a condition where the rule of law should actually be in the hands of trained law enforcement officials, not armed vigilantes. Now, that comes from New Mexico Attorney General Hector Balderas. And he said that in the aftermath of Hopkins' arrest. And it is one of those things that keeps popping up time and time and time again as we go through this administration, especially from what I like to call the angry old men sect. You see, angry old men, which are overrepresented in Congress and now very much in a scared and kind of fearful place where they attack everything that they think is some sort of way of changing their lifestyle or the opportunities afforded to them, these guys have felt especially empowered as of late. And Donald Trump has done nothing to stem their growth. So as he keeps bringing up time and time again these kind of falsified reports of migrants being terrorists, migrants having diseases, migrants being Taliban, migrants being Al-Qaeda, no matter what kind of rhetoric he throws in it, most normal people see it and it's like, ugh, good. And we'll talk about this in just a little bit. Like, the Mueller report basically affirmed to everybody, you don't need a jury to say, hey, the president lies quite a lot. And being a liar and a lying liar that loves to lie a lot, the president's lies have kind of unleashed this nationalistic slash fascist movement among a certain sect of our population. Now, the popularity of nationalism has been on the rise. And when it comes to Hopkins, he was one of the early founders of this rebirth of white nationalism. Going as far back as Oregon in 2006, the Southern Poverty Law Center basically found out that he was caught impersonating an officer of the law and being a felon in possession of a firearm. Now, of course, the U.S. Customs and Border Patrol had to call in to help, you know, make sense of all this. And so what they said in a statement was, they do not support citizens, quote, taking law enforcement into their own hands, and instead encourage the public to be on its eyes and ears of the border, but to actually call the U.S. Customs and Border Protection Agency or local law enforcement if you suspect something is actually wrong. Now, please, Barbecue Betty's. Please, Becky. Remember, it's Barbecue Becky, by the way. I forgot the meme. I'm sorry, Black Twitter. But please don't let this be an excuse for saying, well, now the United States Customs and Border Protection Agency wants us to call in anytime we feel that somebody's being suspicious. Well, they're a minority and they're suspicious. Please. Please do not do that. white people do that way too much this day. But the thing is that when it came to arresting Hopkins, there was kind of this eerie suspicion that things were going to go kind of like they did way back in 2014 when there was a standoff at the Bundy Ranch. You remember that? Bundy, the guy that started trying to take over parks and held a dead cow on a Fox News interview? Yes, he held a dead cow during an interview and just kept talking. Like that was a fashion accessory. But the Bundy thing kind of proved that federal agents need to be a little bit more subtle when arresting these guys. Insofar as, that they create a martyrdom syndrome anytime that they arrest people for doing clear violations of the law. Now, this story would be just absolutely nuts bananas if it wasn't for our next story. Because here's the thing. When we talk about any sort of migrant stories, we always, at least in white society, refer to those stories as brown-on-brown crime, black-on-black crime, Latino-on-Latino crime. But you gotta face facts. People are people, and crime is crime. But with that said, here's the thing. There has been one group that has been absolutely on the rise, on the other side of this whole political swell that Trump has incited. According to the Southern Poverty Law Center, of course, white nationalism has brought back white supremacy. And in one of the strangest stories that we can bring you, about 2 years ago, one of these white supremacists by the name of Frank Nkani kind of disappeared. And then was later found dead down by a river in the state of Missouri where they resided. Now, for a long time, and here's the thing, for the longest time, the Missouri sects of the KKK started to say things like rumblings of, it was a Jewish conspiracy, it was a black conspiracy, something wrong happened to him. Those in the know said, you know, this might have to do with something just a little bit less complicated. And this week, 2 years after his death, an arrest has been made. Melissa Nkani, his wife, sentenced to life in prison after pleading guilty to second-degree murder and other charges. According to a statement, in court she had said, quote, I fired both shots that killed my husband. Now she admitted to cleaning the walls and removing the bedding before dumping the body by a river. Then she said that her husband was missing, took to social media, and begged people with tears in her eyes, please find my husband. Well, according to court records, right before all of those theatrics was staged, the leader of the Missouri wing of the, let me see if I can say this name correctly, Traditionalist American Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, which describes itself as a white patriotic Christian organization that bases its roots back to the Ku Klux Klan of the early 20th century. This guy was basically starting to be made into a martyr. Oh my God, there's a conspiracy against our people. They're killing white folks and Frank Nkani is one of them. Well, no. Frank Nkani apparently got killed because his wife didn't want the divorce. And that was it. Simple, domestic, once again wrapped up in the guise of, oh, fake news and such. But the reason that I bring up this story today is because as much as we want to talk about the rise of hate crimes in the United States, we also have to look at things from just a regular crime as crime lens. And when it comes to this story, it was one that the murmurings along the white supremacist stuff, especially those ones that wear aluminum foil up under their beds at night, hoping that it keeps the satellites from hearing their thoughts. You know which ones I'm talking about. But especially to those guys, the death of a leader of a sect of the white nationalist group, the KKK, kind of does sound like some sort of conspiratory. And if it doesn't sound like it, after a couple of retelling of the stories and enough mystery and time sprinkled in, people are creating martyrs out of everyday idiots. And this story is a perfect example of it. You see, time and time again, when we try to cover the rise of nationalism and stuff in the United States, the rise of white supremacy and stuff like that in the United States, people always say, well, either two school of thoughts, I can't believe that's happening, or it's always been happening, why are we just now talking about it? Well, for the former group, yeah, okay, welcome to the real world. For the latter group, though, the ones that say, why are we still talking about this? It's because for years and years and years within our system, groups like these have been allowing themselves to normalize their behavior as just regular crime, and other crime as some sort of either greater elevated crime, depending on the minority, or lesser concern in the public safety and health debate, i.e. are guns actually a mass epidemic of death, according to the CDC, which would love to study the whole thing, but they can't. You see, when you start to talk about crime in the United States, any lens that you want to paint it on can be advantageous to any group. But when the truth comes out, sometimes in this case, 2 years later, 2 years after the fact, when the truth comes out, the press does a good job about reporting the updates. But the public, you guys, and me, we don't do a good enough job of actually assessing the information as to what it means to the bigger picture at large. And this is what it means when it comes to this story. Particularly this story and other stories like it that have sprung up all along what I like to call the racist belt of the Southeast United States. When it comes to places like that, there's always a chance that some white being attacked was for a very legitimate reason. And if crime happens because somebody got robbed or somebody got mugged, the likelihood of that being racially motivated is very small compared to the instances of where crimes of a petty nature are often poverty motivated. And poverty is something that should unite us all. But thanks to the systematic way that we've retold the narrative of the United States, no, that's not the way it is. And when we talk about this KKK killing, this is a story that got a lot of sensation at the beginning because, ooh, this could be a retaliation. This could be a retaliation. And the problem is that people actually hungered for this to have some sort of racial overlying motivating factors. And when it turned out to not have those, well, then the whole thing just kind of got meh. Meh. But when we look at stories like this, especially because here's the deal. The only reason I know this story exists is because the initial stories, yeah, started off in the United States in the state of Mississippi. I had to actually find this from the British news sources that printed this as one of their regular, oh, silly American stories. You see, the United States media has very, very, very little audience for people that want the truth. And over this weekend, especially because this weekend has been particularly tumultuous as far as what has been said in the media, what has been digested in the Mueller report already and disseminated, and what is to come from all of the findings and discoveries, with that being this week, we're quick to kind of jump over stories that are foundational to our understanding of how society works. At least American society. In American society, I've seen a lot of complaints from people that say, you know what, the media is obviously just kicking a dead horse with these stories. Over and over again, we just hear the same details. We need to, oh my God, here it is. We need to ignore the media, or we need to only trust X media. And that goes both ways. Blue and red states alike all have their preferences. But the fact of the matter is that because we only tell the sensational, the sizzle part of the stories and never really follow up with, and this is the problem, the regular reality of the nuts and bolts of everyday life and prosecutions, hearings, Like, think about it. When's the last time you actually picked up a paper and thought, I need to know what's happening at my local council? These laws could actually impact me because council, city, county, or otherwise, is the most accessible and most responsive and directly responsible for my daily life form of government. When's the last time we did that? Well, we don't. Because instead, we'd rather read about this person got caught doing this, this person got caught doing that, the sensational stuff that comes up front. But when it comes to the procedures that have to go into the actual fact-finding, and then sometimes the contradictory evidence that might come up later in an investigation, we as a viewing, news-consuming public aren't really excited about those things. And because we're not excited about the nuts and bolts of actual life in the United States media doesn't really cover stories that do follow-up. And that's led to, well, some particularly interesting things, like this story. Sensationalized some 2 years ago, but now, barely a blip on the radar. Is it because, oh my God, the facts no longer support this polarized nature of things being wonky in the United States? No. No, it's not that at all. It's the fact that when it comes to actually getting in what happened, when it happened, and how it happened, what relevance it has to what may happen in the future, what relevance it could have had to actions promoted, maybe through, let's just go ahead and say, lies to other groups in the past and the ramifications of that misinformation going forward. Stories like this actually kind of parallel what we're doing in the media when it comes to the Mueller report. Now, after the break, of course, I am going to talk all about the Mueller report and things like that. Plus, we'll do a brief section where we catch up on all the Nexium guys. Remember the Nexium story? But before we get there, let's talk about the parallels between this story and the Mueller investigation. The reason I bring it up is because we are almost to the point of Mueller fatigue in the United States. There's only so many sensational revelations that can come out in a 24-hour period before your brain merely locks up over all the breaking news that is breaking into your skull. So when it comes to the long-term ramifications of what the Mueller report could mean, what it means for our democracy, what it means for our foreign diplomacy, especially with a country like Russia, a known manipulator of elections outside of its sovereign borders, these things will have weight and matter. But will we have the attention span to actually give them time to roll out? Or will we be just as guilty as residents in Missouri, who latched on to this big story that happened with their leaders being killed, one of the white supremacist group, at the beginning of it? But then as the investigation wore on and nothing was fine, they just kind of made up their own theory and moved on. Now, don't get me wrong, that's a very human condition, whereas humans hate mysteries. So sometimes, even to ourselves, unbeknownst to other people outside of our own skulls, we invent our own narratives just so that we can explain mysterious things in our head. That's why everybody has those stories that is like, you're not going to believe what happened this time or that time. Well, human experience is pretty limited in what we can and can't experience, so yeah, I would believe something happened to somebody else. It's just we like to sensationalize them for our own validation. And that kind of validation is rubbed off on mainstream media, which, by the way, the Mueller report kind of defended us on. And I'll explain that after the break, but where we are now is in United States news-consuming society. We latch on to those details that are sensational, that are salacious, that we can jump to the water coolers, and, oh, you're not going to believe what I heard. We latch on to those stuff, so much so that the media, knowing that they have to stay in business by selling ads and stuff, only inundates us with stories that give us this urgent anxiety kind of induced tone. But when it comes to actual fact-finding, digging up the stuff that matters to the story, things that will have real-world implications, we, and the media at large, is kind of less interested in the United States about following up. Now, going past 2020, whether Trump is a president or not, we do need to reanalyze how consumption and specifically how presenting news in the United States is done. Versus everybody going into their own little echo chambers and stuff, there needs to be some sort of national consensus of information that we all find viable and actionable. Because as it stands, just like the case of this story that I've been talking about, where a guy was killed and everybody thought there was a huge conspiracy and it just turned out to be a petty domestic dispute with his wife, we're not interested in the boring and the mundane. No, instead, we want the sensational. We want the, the scary feelings. And that's why we have to be very careful when discussing what happens next after the Mueller report's release, because America, we're getting very close to suffering news fatigue with it, and this is something that will have impact for years. Don't lose sight of that. And stay close. We'll come back with more after the break. It's the Shaggy Jenkins Show.
Dig deeper. Remove the hype. Find the facts. It's the Shaggy Jenkins Show on the Pacifica Radio Network.
It's the Shaggy Jenkins Show on the Pacifica Radio Network. Welcome back. Now, if you missed any part of the first part of the show, it's easy to catch up with us. Just follow us on Spotify or, well, anywhere else. Fine podcasting is served. Just look for the Shaggy Jenkins Show. You can also find me at my website, shaggyjenkins.com, and on social media at Shaggy Live. Let's get back into some of the stories that we're following up on today. And one of the stories that I have been following for a while, including with all the correspondents, we've kind of talked about this Keith Rainier story and Nexium. Now, it first came out in utterances of, oh my God, that's kind of creepy and human trafficking and such, but then evolved into a even bigger story where a very rich kind of power structure was used to subjugate certain women within the entertainment industry. And of course, as the salacious details wore on, well, the trials eventually made them their way to court. Now, as such, and we're talking about those, we need to talk about some of those rich influencers behind Keith Rainier's reign. Now, when it comes to Nexium, Nexium was this quote-unquote self-help group that basically was found out to be a huge sex cult. And there was a couple of different scary things that came out about actress Allison Mack and the heiress of the Seagram's alcohol fortune, one Claire Bronfman. Now, she, for the longest time, in document after document, has kind of been named as the big money structure support behind Rainier's ability to use Nexium in the way that he did. Now, she recently just got out of court and pled guilty to two counts: conspiracy to conceal and harbor illegal immigrants for financial gain. That's actually just one charge there. And of course, fraudulent use of identification. She told the courtroom that she was truly remorseful and, quote, I wanted to do good in the world and help people. However, I have made mistakes. Mistakes? Since 1998, the self-help program has said, you know, of course, we've worked with thousands and thousands of people, a community guided by humanitarian principles. Of course, they had the tagline, working to build a better world. And all of the nice fluffy stuff on their site couldn't cover up the whole slave and master system within it. One of them, of course, was named after computer programming, DOS, D-O-S. But the group's website, it's basically stopped all the enrollment and events because of extraordinary circumstances facing the company at this time. Those include the leader, Keith Rainier, being alleged to have done some pretty rapey things and a lot of illegal things to boot. Now, Bronfman, who was, basically a daughter of the late Canadian businessman Edgar Bronfman, had a net worth of about $2.6 billion. She was on the executive board of Nexium. Now, the millions of dollars she funneled into the company was, alleged to have given the group more identities, fake, and more power and resources to keep court summons and other perceived enemies away from what Nexium was actually doing. Now, some of the things they were doing was branding people with this sacred brand that actually later was found to contain Keith and actress Allison Mack's initials. Now, she also pled guilty not too long ago to her role in this. In the same Brooklyn court that Bronfman went through, she said, quote, "I must take full responsibility of my conduct." What was her conduct? Well, she pled guilty to racketeering and racketeering conspiracy charges. That doesn't get the human trafficking and all of the other kind of crazy stuff that Mack was alleged to have done and was originally some of the charges that they came, to file against her. Now, she was one of the ones that was particularly key in recruiting women. And these women include people like former Battlestar Galactica and Hawaii Five-O actress Grace Park, all the way up to Canadian actress Sarah Chapman. There was a lot of different famous women on your small screen that ended up in this Nexium group thanks to Allison Mack's contribution. Now, this is the thing. Her role in all of this was to collect compromising materials and images of two women within the group. These images included nude pictures, letters where they smack-talked their entire family and said bad things about everybody close to them that, of course, Mack kept, so that later, if these women were ever to turn against the group, these letters and compromising material could be used in Nexium's defense. But Mack, this is the thing, said in court that she still believed, after all of these activities that she was instructed to do by the founder, said that she believed that Rainier's intention was to help people. Now, of course, he was arrested in Mexico last year, and his defense team argued that the alleged sexual relationships that he had, hundreds, by the way, were all consensual. And Mack, although she originally pled not guilty, when the stacks of evidence started to come out against her, he said, "You know what, I'm just going to take it guilty." Now, she's scheduled to be sentenced in September. She could face up to 20 years in prison for each of those two charges. Like Bronfman, who is going to also be reappearing back in the fall for her sentencing, we don't know how long it could go for her on those charges. Now, here's the thing. When it comes to the rise of the Nexium group, one of the strangest things that we followed on this story was how it was allowed to get away for so long without being caught for what it obviously was, which was a rape cult. And now we find out, thanks to the conviction and guilty plea by heiress Claire Bronfman, it was her money, the Seagram's alcohol fortune, that propped up the whole Nexium power structure, which was then led on by celebrities like Mack, who used it to collect, tons of famous people and then do horrific things with them. Speaking of horrific things and collecting people, it's now time to move on to the story that has been dominating the news ever since it came out, the infamous Mueller report. And a lot of things over the weekend has us asking, after scratching our head long and hard, what comes next? Well, let's talk first about just politicians and their official result, their official reaction. Because one politician actually decided to take to Twitter on Easter Sunday and say, you know, I've got some things to say about all this. Now, keep in mind, over the weekend, there was a very big international attack in the country of Sri Lanka that killed some 200 people in a religious-motivated assault. Of course, investigations are still ongoing in that, but here in the United States, nobody was reacting to that because they were all busy talking about the Mueller report. And one guy who's kind of been, let's just say, on the Republican side, but not on the side of Trump for the longest time, is Senator Mitt Romney, the Utah senator who was a former presidential candidate. In an official press release yesterday, he says, quote, "It is good news that there was insufficient evidence to charge the President of the United States with having conspired with a foreign adversary or with having obstructed justice." Now, keep in mind, this is a senator saying that it's good news there was insufficient evidence to charge the President of the United States. However, when you actually look at the Mueller report, how do I say this? That's not what it said at all. In fact, what it said was, there is all these instances where we can make the case for obstruction of justice, but because of the guidelines assigned to us by the Department of Justice, we are not to go criminally after a sitting United States president. All we can do is give you all of the breadcrumbs and all of the evidence in 10 different instances of when bad things happened. And our hope, at least this is, you know, paraphrasing here heavily and probably me making some sort of alliteration to actual feelings, I have no basis of understanding. So let's just say it like this. The prosecutor set up an amazing case that they thought somebody of a higher authority, vis-a-vis the Senate or the House of Representatives, could then take their evidence as a discovery and start their own investigations that would lead into either impeachment or whatever viable criminal prosecutions needed to happen around this case. They didn't make the case for obstruction in so much as they presented 10 different scenarios of actual obstructive type behavior and said, because of our guidelines, we can't say conclusively it was obstruction, but look at all the evidence of the obstruction. But still yet, Republican sides are already jumping on this as, hey, insufficient evidence to charge the president. That's good news. And that's the narrative that Mitt Romney takes. However, in his statement, he also kind of paints something different than what the rest of the GOP is jumping on. You see, when it came to the Mueller report and Barr's initial cheerleading four-page summary and then his preemptive press conference where he basically come out and spun a completely fabricated narrative to what was in the report hours before it was released to Senate. In time after time after time like this, the GOP's official stance has been, this is and was a witch hunt. This was fake. This was drummed up. And actually, it's poor President Trump suffering presidential harassment. Now, Mitt Romney, of course, being a Republican, you would expect him to be straight on that bandwagon. And keep in mind, that bandwagon is airtight. There is no gray area where, you know, I'm glad the president wasn't charged with obstruction, but gosh, some crappy things happened there, don't you think? There is no gray area like that until Mitt Romney came along and made this in his statement. Quote, the alternative, and this is talking about his, you know, conspiring with a foreign adversary and obstructing justice, he goes, the alternative would have taken us through a wretched process with the potential for a constitutional crisis. The business of government can now move on. Oh, can it now? Even so, and this is him, even so, I am sickened at the extent and pervasiveness of dishonesty and misdirection by individuals in the highest office of the land, including the president. I am also appalled that, among other things, fellow citizens working in a campaign for president welcomed help from Russia, including information that had been illegally obtained, that none of them acted to inform the American law enforcement, and that the campaign chairman was actively promoting Russian interest in Ukraine. Reading the report is a sobering revelation of how far we have strayed from the aspirations and principles of the founders. Does this sound like a GOP statement, or at least a statement from somebody within the GOP? No, it doesn't. But Mitt Romney has never openly been a fan of Donald Trump. And Donald Trump didn't waste any time in going after, well, Mitt Romney. See, it turns out that Donald Trump, ahead of his Sunday Easter activities, had nothing to do other than sit on Twitter. And when it came to his official response, which has been his official response from day one, no collusion, no obstruction, radical left, always against him, the deep state thing, I won against the deep state haters. Even went as far as saying, you know, this is presidential harassment. And in a quote on Easter Sunday from Donald Trump's Twitter, quote, can you believe that I had to go through the worst and most corrupt political witch hunt in the history of the United States, parentheses, no collusion, when it was the other side that illegally created a diversionary and criminal event and even spied on my campaign, disgraceful. These are all things taken from William Barr's testimony and public statement. Those statements are unfounded. And in one case, the spying, it just happens to do with, well, the language that William Barr talks in versus the public interpretation of people that don't know that he just uses the word spy instead of surveilled. Two different, way different legal definitions behind those two words. But Donald Trump jumped up onto Mitt Romney's case, basically saying that he was in this whole conspiracy to impeach a Republican president for a crime that was committed by the Democrats. But when it comes to the actual Mueller report, here's the thing. Some sections of it are going, well, or should I say, pertain to ongoing investigations. And when it comes to those ongoing investigations, the thing that Donald Trump didn't mention in his statement, and even though Mitt Romney's statement was, ooh, tough for a GOP person to stand up against the official narrative, which is no obstruction, no collusion. Everything was a witch hunt. We Republicans were right. The Democrats were wrong. Mueller's a Democrat. Instead of that last part is actually something they're trying to spin, which makes no sense whatsoever. But when we talk about the statements that have come out officially from the GOP and how far Senator Romney's deviate from it, they're both missing the point. Because if you broke down all of the things that, like, let's just make a quick summary here of what happened, okay? Let's say that in the political circuit, and a reporter for the, I think it was the New York Times, Quinta Jurerik, he made this nice little flow chart. Because this is the thing, in a legal sense, everybody is kind of, well, trying to quote the Mueller report, which is particularly wordy, bringing out legal experts trying to explain it, and let's just face facts. A lot of times, it takes a lot more than one explanation for people to get it. But that's not effective. So Quinta made a flow chart, and it breaks down like this. If you look at all the sections of the Mueller report and what they do say, what they don't say, what they do make clear in a legal defining sense, and what shows intent. Oh, and those things that exist within the nexus area between them, you know? The gray area of, was there an obstructive act with intent? Well, if you break those things down into a chart, let's just go through some of the major findings. First, when it comes to the Flynn investigation, was Donald Trump actually working with an obstructive act in a legal defining sense? Yes. Was there intent behind that act? Yes. What was the intent? Get Michael Flynn out of the radar of the investigation that he was under from the FBI. Now, when it came to the Comey announcement of the Russian investigation, did Donald Trump make an obstructive act? Well, that's kind of where it gets weird, because he both said, yeah, maybe something's happening, but he also said nothing could possibly ever happen. Putin is our friend. So when it came to Trump's behavior around this time of Comey announcing an investigation behind Russia's role in the 2016 election, it doesn't exonerate. And this is the thing. A lot of people toss this word around. Exonerate means it doesn't free Trump from the shadow of, was this an obstructive act in his role behind Comey and the Russian investigation. At the stage of the announcement of it, it's kind of unknown. It was kind of below the radar. But was there intent to kind of go against Comey in a retaliatory sense for this? Yes. And when it comes to the next finding in Mueller's report, when it comes to Comey's firing, is that considered an obstructive act? Yes. What about all the efforts to fire special investigators and special prosecutor Robert Mueller? That, all of those efforts, which are detailed in the report, those are an obstructive act. Efforts to curtail or slow down the Mueller investigation. All of the things that the Trump camp and the administration did, those are considered obstruction of justice acts. Obstructive acts. Now, when it came to the disclosure of the Trump Tower meeting, there is a very big red block in this chart. And the reason why is because it seems like the Trumps really didn't care to bring up the Trump Tower meeting at all. They just brought up no collusion, no obstruction. But what about the meetings? No obstruction, no collusion. But the meeting. It seems like when it came to all of the discussions around that infamous summer of 2016 meeting in the Trump Towers, the Trump camp took no obstructive role, had no intent of taking an obstructive role in it, and didn't even want to address it publicly, just basically skipping over it. Now, Donald Trump also put a lot of pressure on his then Attorney General, Jeff Sessions. Jeff Sessions had recused himself early on in the special prosecutor's investigation into Russia's role because of, well, he just thought that he was a little compromised. That, and he's really horrible at answering questions under investigation, which is the whole thing that caused his possible perjury. But Jeff Sessions recused himself, and time and time and time again, not only Trump directly, but members of his inner circle and protectors, urged Jeff Sessions to unrecuse himself and take over the investigation. And that goes back to curtailing Mueller and then firing Mueller. That is an obstructive act. And the Mueller report says, yes, Trump participated in an obstructive act. When it came to having his personal attorney, the president's counsel, McGahn, attempt to fire Robert Mueller in what would have been the most blatant example of a Nixonian Saturday night massacre, that's when, infamously, McGahn resigned all of a sudden. Well, even urging his counsel to go after the special counsel and say, look, you're fired, just like in, you know, The Apprentice. Having that conversation with McGahn, between Trump and McGahn, even that conversation is showing the intent to create an obstructive act. And whether or not he actually acted on it, instead he chose to resign, McGahn and Trump at this point are in an actual past intent trying to commit an obstructive act. Now, there's the conduct towards Flynn that the White House was kind of iffy on. The conduct towards Cohen's testimony while it was happening, but in the aftermath, clearly jumped on. Those are a little gray area. There's unclear findings in those. And sometimes those unclear findings have a lot to do with the fact that, given the guidelines that the Department of Justice put on the special prosecutor, there were some things they absolutely positively couldn't say happened because legally it would get them into some murky water between that whole can you indict a sitting U.S. president. But when they said, when it came towards influencing the investigation around Paul Manafort, including influencing the jury, influencing Manafort by dangling presidential pardons over his head, saying that he would have help from the outside, all of that stuff, those are obstructive acts, and yes, have intent for obstruction of justice acts, except when it comes to the jury part. Juries are usually kind of sequestered away, so you can't really go at them with any gusto of intent. You kind of have to only act when they're in the court. And as such, you know, through pressures and public statements and things of that nature, Trump's administration and camp did try to obstruct Manafort's trial. Now, when it comes to Roger Stone, there's a lot of not applicable or not available statements there. The reason why is because we don't know how far that investigation will go forward. But at the end of the day, when you're looking at the Mueller report, remember, just because it can't prosecute doesn't mean it can't lay out the case for 10 different instances of obstruction of justice. That's going to do it for our show. See you tomorrow. Love you, mean it. Gate in, bye.